Welcome everybody to the online course on the Nibbana Sermons 12 to 22 by Bhikkhu Katakurunda Nyanananda, hosted in collaboration by the Numata Center for Buddhist Studies at the University of Hamburg and the Barrett Center for Buddhist Studies in Massachusetts. And today we are going to take up Sermon 20. But before that, just a few extracts from the discussion in the online forum. Yeah, the comments I have here are mainly from those who have commented on my discussion of this whole idea of Mara coming to grab and seize the Buddha or the Arahants at the time of their passing away. Bhikkhu Nidamadina says, when the Buddha is challenged by Mara early on his career, the texts do not describe such encounters in terms of Mara potentially grabbing the Buddha and him letting go, for example. Even in the episodes in which Mara challenges Arahat monks and nuns in the Theragata and Therigata, this is never subjectively described by the Arahat monk or nun in terms of Mara coming to grab or threaten it in any way, nor are they shown to enter the Arahata Palasamadhi in order to dispel Mara. And Hedwig commented that when experiencing anything, including death, the unshakable, unagitated condition of mind of the Arahant will not change. He or she is always free from the hindrances, bondages, and taints. He or she has flung off the fetters and has gone beyond reckoning. So Mara cannot grab the Arahant even during his or her residual lifetime. And Andilan, when ignorance is eradicated, there is no foothold for Mara, nothing for Mara to grab and seize. Therefore, there would be no need to nullify the power of Mara by directing one's mind to a concentration, and no need to resort to the unshakable deliverance of the mind, since that is the quality of a Buddha's or an Arahant's mind already. Yeah, so I'm glad that the others also agree with my presentation in this respect, and perhaps we can then leave the epithets like the island and refuge, etc., to convey their positive connotations as metaphors, not as something to be taken literal, as an actual island somewhere, but still as positive images that can help to counter a tendency to see Nibbana as merely a question of annihilation or extinction, and see that there is the negative and there's the positive, and so we find a middle path in our appraisal of Nibbana and of its significance, which clearly stays away from the dangers of eternalism, of reifying Nibbana into a place, an actual island somewhere out there, but also avoiding the other extreme, the equating of Nibbana with mere annihilation. And moving onwards from this topic, then I wanted to comment again on the beauty of the simile of the floral design. There are always these beautiful similes that the Venerable Nyanananda is able to offer, which can really deeply inspire the meditation practice. And this idea of craving as the glue, and views as the tangle, and conceit as the knot. I feel they make so much sense when one looks at it from the actual view of practice, or the sticky nature of craving. And when we turn what we experience into views and uphold them, we so easily get tangled. And then just the conceit, this I-making and my-making as a knot, I find this very powerful from a practical perspective. And so with this we move on to Sermon 20. etang santam etang panitam yadidam sabba sankara samato sabbu panipati nissaggo tanhankayo virago nirodo nibbanam. This is peaceful and this is excellent, namely the stilling of all preparations, the relinquishment of all assets, the destruction of craving, detachment, cessation, extinction. With the permission of the Most Venerable Great Preceptor and the assembly of the Venerable Meditative Monks, this is the 20th sermon in the series of the sermons on Nibbana. In our last sermon, we described as something of a marvel in the attainment of Nibbana, the very possibility of realizing in this very life as Nitya Dhammika, once after death state, which is Samparayika. The phrase Nityeva Dhamme Sayam Abhinya Sanchikatva, having realized here and now by one's own higher knowledge, occurs so often in the discourses because the emancipated one ascertains his after-death state as if by seeing with his own eyes. Natanti dani punabhavo, there is no re-becoming now. Kina jati, extinct is birth, are some of the joyous utterances of the Buddha and the Arahants, which were inspired by the realization of the cessation of existence in this very life. Through that realization itself, they experience a bliss devoid of feeling, which is called the cooling off of feelings. That is why Nibbana as such is known as Avidaita Sukha, a bliss devoid of feeling. At the end of their lives, at the moment when death approaches, those emancipated ones, the Arahants, put forward their unshakable deliverance of the mind, Akuppa Cheta Vimutti, which remains unshaken even in the face of death, and become deathless well before their death, not after it. On many an occasion, the Buddha has spoken highly of this unshakable deliverance of the mind, describing it as the supreme bliss, and the supreme knowledge, and the supreme freedom from death. For instance, among the sixes of the Anguttara Nikaya, we come across the following two verses. Tassa samma vimuttassa jnanam chihoti tarino akuppa me vimuttiti bhava samyojanankaye etam ko paramam jnanam etam sukkamanuttaram asokam virajankhemam etam mananyam muttamam. To that such like one who is fully released, there arises the knowledge, unshakable is my deliverance, upon his extinction of fetters to existence. This is the highest knowledge, this is the unsurpassed bliss. The soulless stainless security is the supreme depthlessness. Common translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi, with the destruction of the fetters of existence, for the stable one rightly liberated, the knowledge occurs. My liberation is unshakable. This is the supreme knowledge. This is unsurpassed happiness. Soulless, dust-free and secure, this is the highest freedom from death. And here translation from the Madhyama Agama parallel of the last two stanzas, the parallel to the last two stanzas. Having attained an unworldly happiness, purified as if bathed with water, his imperturbable mind is liberated and all bonds of existence are eradicated. Nirvana is freedom from ailment. It is called the unsurpassable lamp. Freedom from grief, freedom from dust, peace. This is called the imperturbable. And the topic of depth occurs in an earlier stanza. It goes, this bondage is the most profound suffering. A hero, however, is free from it. One who obtains his wealth in accordance with the Dharma will not incur debt, but will be at peace. End of comment. Arahants are said to be debtless in regard to the four requisites offered by the laity out of faith. But when Nibbana is regarded as a debtlessness, it seems to imply something deeper. Samsara, or reiterated existence, is itself a debt, which one can never pay off. When one comes to think of karma and its result, it is a debt that keeps on gathering an interminable interest, which can never be paid off. But even from this death, the Arahants have won freedom by destroying the seeds of Kamma, by rendering them infertile. They are made ineffective beyond this life, as there is no rebirth. The meaningful line of the Ratana Sutta, Kinang Puranang Navangnatan Tisambhavan, whatever is old is extinct, and there is no arising anew, has to be understood in that sense. The karmic debt is paid off, and there is no fresh incurring. All this is in praise of that unshakable deliverance of the mind. It is a kind of extraordinary knowledge, almost unimaginable, a realization of one's own after-death state. In almost all serious discussions on Nibbana, the sattva's moot point turns out to be the question of the after-death state of the emancipated one. A brief answer the Buddha had given to this question we already brought up in our last sermon by quoting the two concluding verses of the Udana, with which that collection of inspired utterances ends with a note of exceptional grandeur. Let us recall them. Ayoga hanatasiva jalato jata viraso anupumbu pasantasa yathana nyayati gati evang samma vimuttanam kama bandhoga tharinam panya petong gati nadi pattanam achalang sukham. Just as in the case of a fire blazing like a block of iron in point of compactness, when it gradually comes down, no path it goes by can be traced. Even so, of those who are well released, who have crossed over the flux of shackles of sensuality and reached bliss unshaken, there is no path to be pointed out. Comment, translation by Ireland. Just as the bourne is not known of the gradual fading glow given off by the furnace-heated iron as it is struck with the smith hammer, so there is no pointing to the bourne of those perfectly released who have crossed the flood of bondage to sense desires and attained unshakable bliss. End of comment. The last two lines are particularly significant. There is no path to be pointed out of those who have reached a bliss unshaken, achalang sukham, or unshakable bliss, is none other than that unshakable deliverance of the mind. Akuppa means unassailable or unshakable. Clearly enough, what the verse says is that after their death, the emancipated ones leave no trace of a path gone by, even as the flames of a raging fire. The flame may appear something really existing due to the perception of the compact, ghana sanya, but when it goes down and disappears, no one can say that it went in such and such a direction. Though this is the obvious meaning, some try to attribute quite a different meaning to the verse in question. The line panya petung katinatanti, there is no path to be pointed out, is interpreted even by the commentators, who take the word gati to mean some state of existence, as an assertion that although such a bourne cannot be pointed out, the arahants pass away into some nondescript realm. This kind of interpretation is prompted by an apprehension of the charge of annihilation. A clear instance of this tendency is revealed in the commentary to the following verse in the Dhammapada. Ahimsa kaye munayu nityam kayena sammuta ye yanti achyutang thanam yathagantvana suchare. Innocent are the sages that are ever restrained in body. They go to that state unshaken wherein they grieve no more. Common translation by K.R. Norman. Sages who do no harm, constantly restrained in body, they go to the unshakable place where, having gone, they do not grieve. End of comment. The commentator, in paraphrasing, brings in the word sasatang, eternal, for achyutang, thereby giving the idea that the arahants go to an eternal place of rest. Because the verb yanti, go, occurs there, he must have thought that this state, unshaken, achyutang, is something attainable after death. But we can give another instance in support of our explanation of the term achyutang. The following verse in the Hemakamana Vapuccha of the Parayana Vanga in the Sutta Nipata clearly shows what this Achyutang is. Ida ditta sutta mutta vinyateso piyarupesu hemaka chanda raga vinodanan nibbana param achyutang. The dispelling here in this world of desire and lust in pleasurable things, seen, heard, sensed and cognized, is the unshaken state of nibbana, o hemaka. Common translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. The dispelling of desire and lust, Hemaka, for things here seen, heard, sensed and cognized, for whatever has a pleasing nature, is the state of Nibbana, the imperishable. End of comment. This is further proof of the fact that there is no eternal immortal rest awaiting the Arahants after their demise. The reason for such a postulate is probably the fear of falling into the annihilationist view. Why this chronic fear? To the worldlings overcome by craving for existence, any teaching that leads to the cessation of existence appears dreadful. That is why they put forward two new parables following the same commentarial trend. The other day we mentioned about those two parables, the parable of the tortoise and the parable of the frog. When the fish and the toad living in water ask what sort of a thing land is, the tortoise and the frog are forced to say no, no, to every question they put. Likewise the Buddha, so is argued, was forced to give a string of negative terms in his discourses on Nibbana. But we have pointed out that this argument is fallacious, and that those discourses have to be interpreted differently. The theme that runs through such discourses is none other than the cessation of existence. In the Alagadupama Sutta of the Majjhima Nikaya, the Buddha declares in unmistakable terms that some recluses and Brahmins, on hearing him preaching the Dhamma for the cessation of existence, wrongly accuse him with the charge of being an annihilationist. Sato sattasya udanchedang vinnasang vibhavang panyapeti. He is showing the way to the annihilation, destruction and non-existence of a truly existing being. He clearly states that some even grieve and lament and fall into despair, complaining, Ochinjissami namasu, vinassissami namasu, nasu nama bhavissami. So it seems I shall be annihilated, so it seems I shall perish, so it seems I shall be no more. Even during the lifetime of the Buddha, there were various debates and controversies regarding the after-death state of the emancipated person among recluses and Brahmins. They were of the opinion that the after-death state of the emancipated one in any particular religious system has to be explained according to a fourfold logic or tetralemma. A paradigm of that tetralemma occurs quite often in the discourses. It consists of the following four propositions. Hoti tathagata paramarana, nahoti tathagata paramarana, hoti cha na cha hoti tathagata paramarana, neva hoti na nahoti tathagata paramarana. The Tathagata exists after death, the Tathagata does not exist after death, the Tathagata both exists and does not exist after death, the Tathagata neither exists nor does not exist after death. This four-cornered logic purports to round up the four possible alternatives in any situation, or four possible answers to any question. The dilemma is fairly well known, where one is caught up between two alternatives. The tetralemma with its four alternatives is supposed to exhaust the universe of discourse in a way that one cannot afford to ignore it. When it comes to a standpoint regarding a particular issue, one is compelled to say yes or no, or at least to assert both standpoints or negate them altogether. The contemporary recluses and Brahmins held on to the view that the Tathagata's after-death state has to be predicated in accordance with the four-cornered logic. When we hear the term Tathagata, we are immediately reminded of the Buddha. But for the contemporary society, it was a sort of technical term with a broader meaning. Those recluses and Brahmins used the term Tathagata to designate the perfected individual in any religious system, whose qualifications were summed up in the thematic phrase, Uttama Puriso, Parama Puriso, Parama Patti Patto. The highest person, the supreme person, the one who has attained the supreme state. This fact is clearly borne out in the Kutuhala Sala Sutta, in the Abhyakata Samyutta of the Samyutta Nikaya. In that discourse, we find the wandering ascetic Vachikotta coming to the Buddha with the following report. Recently, there was a meeting of recluses, Brahmins, and wandering ascetics in the debating hall. In that assembly, the following chance talk arose. Now, there is this teacher, Purana Kassapa, who is widely acclaimed and who has a large following. When an ordinary disciple of his passes away, he predicates his destiny. So also in the case of a disciple who has attained the highest state of perfection in his religious system. Other well-known teachers like Kalingosala, Nigantha Nathaputta, Sanjaya Bilattiputta, Pakuda Kachayana, and Ajita Kesakambali do the same. They all declare categorically the after-death state of both types of their disciples. Comment. Here I have a footnote by Bhikkhu Bodhi on his translation of this part where he comments that it is strange that predictions about rebirth are ascribed to Ajita, since elsewhere he is reported to have taught materialism and to have denied an afterlife. I checked the Chinese parallels, and both of them do not mention the six teachers at all, so they only have the discussion between Vachagotta and the Buddha. And I think that the Pali passage may have suffered from some slight stereotyping during oral transmission. And so perhaps the point in this part would have been that like Purana Kassapa would have given a statement on the actual rebirth, and then materialists like Ajita, they would simply have denied, they would still have made statements in the context of the Tetralemma. They would just have said that the ordinary disciple is not reborn and the accomplished saint is also not reborn because they were denying rebirth. These six teachers are not too well preserved in the Buddhist traditions. If we look at the classical place where they come up with their ideas and views is the Samanyapala Sutta, the second discourse in the Digha Nikaya. We find that in the parallel versions, extant in Sanskrit in the Sangha Beda Vastu and the several Chinese parallels, the doctrines each of them holds are clearly being confused with each other. And it seems, for example, the view held by Makali Gosala in the Pali version is a mixture of two different views. So it seems that the Buddhist tradition, excuse me, the reciters were somewhere aware of this group of six and of some of the views they held, but who held what view is not always clear. In fact, we find even in the Pali tradition, they are sometimes given different and contradictory views. And so it is perhaps not surprising that in the process of oral transmission, this particular passage may have been somewhat standardized, and that the original idea was that Purana Kassapa, for example, was saying, okay, my normal disciples are reborn there, and my fully awakened disciples are reborn here, and that those who held materialist views, like those attributed in the Pali tradition to Pakuda Kachayana and particularly to Ajita Kesakambali, would simply have taken the no-rebirth position among the Tetralemma. End of comment. But as for this ascetic Gotama, who also is a teacher widely acclaimed with a large following, the position is that he clearly declares the after-death state of an ordinary disciple of his. But in the case of a disciple who has attained the highest state of perfection, he does not predicate his destiny according to the above-mentioned Tetralemma. Instead, he makes such a declaration about him as the following. Atanchenchitanhang vavatantayi sanyojanam sammamanavisamayam antangakasi dukkassa. He cut off craving, disjoint the fetter, and by rightly understanding conceit for what it is, made an end of suffering. Comment, translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. He cut off craving, severed the fetter, and by completely breaking through conceit, he made an end to suffering. End of comment. Avadhincha Gautanta concludes this account with a confession that he himself was perplexed and was in doubt as to how the Dhamma of the recluse Gautama has to be understood. The Buddha grants that Vajjagata's doubt is reasonable with the words Alanhite Avadhincha Kankitong Alang Vichikichitong Kankaniyicha Panate Thane Vichikicha Upanna. It behoves you to doubt, Avadhincha. It behoves you to be perplexed, for doubt has arisen in you on a dubious point. Comment, translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. It is fitting for you to be perplexed, Vajja. It is fitting for you to doubt. Doubt has arisen in you about a perplexing matter. Yeah, I wanted to mention that in the parallel, in the Samyukta Agama, there is no approval of Vajjakota's doubt. And in the present context, in fact, Vajjakota is anyway so confused and keeps on coming back to these views over and over again. He appears so many times in the suttas with his views. It is in fact a little bit questionable whether it is actually meaningful to encourage him to have doubt. And this difference is a persistent difference between Pali oral transmission and the oral transmission of the Sarvastivada and or Mula Sarvastivada tradition as extant in the Madhyama Agama, in the Samyukta Agama. We consistently find that the Pali versions, there is an encouragement to doubt. It is fitting for you to doubt, as here. And we do not have this in the Chinese parallels. And a particular noteworthy instance is the famous Kala Lama Sutta, where in the Pali version the Buddha encourages doubt. In the Chinese he does not encourage them to have doubt. And I've discussed this in an article that surveys different Madhyama Agama passages that significantly differ from their Pali parallels. And this is one of the two readings I am offering for this lecture. And on this issue of doubt in the Kalama Sutta, you could particularly say page 9 and 10. End of comment. Then the Buddha comes out with the correct standpoint in order to dispel Vajjakota's doubt. Saupadanasya kvahang vajja upapatting panyapimi no anupadanasya. It is for one with grasping vajja that I declare there is an occurrence of birth, not for one without grasping. He gives the following simile by way of illustration. Sayutabhi vajja angi saupadana jalati no anupadana. Evameva kvahang vajja saupadanasya upapatting panyapimi no anupadanasya. Just as a fire burns when it has fuel to grasp, and not when it has no fuel, even so, Vajja, I declare that there is an occurrence of birth for one with grasping, not for one without grasping. As we have mentioned before, the word upadana has two meanings. It means both grasping as well as fuel. In fact, fuel is just what the fire grasps. Just as the fire depends on grasping in the form of fuel, so also the individual depends on grasping for his rebirth. Within the context of this analogy, Vajjagata now raises a question that has some deeper implications. Yasming pana bhogotama samaye achivatena kittaduarampi gacchati emasapana bhavangotamo kingupadanasming panyapeti. Master Gautama, at the time when a flame, flung by the wind, goes even far, what does Master Gautama declare to be his object of grasping or fuel? The Buddha's answer to that question is, Yasminko vajja samaye anchi va tena kitta durampi gacchati tamahang vatupadanang vadami vato hisa vajja tasmin samaye upadanang hoti. At the time, Vajja, when a flame flung by the wind goes even far, that I say has wind as its object of grasping. Vajja, at that time, wind itself serves as the object of grasping. No, this is only an analogy. Vacha raises the question proper only at this point. Yasmincha pana bhogotama samaye imancha kayang nikinkipati satto cha anyataram kayang anubandho hoti imasapana bhavangotamo king upadanasming panyaveti. At the time, Master Gotama, when a being lays down this body and has reached a certain body, what does Master Gotama declare to be a grasping in his case? The Buddha replies, Yasmin chapana vancha samaye imancha kayam nikimpati satto cha anyataram kayam anupaddo hoti tamaham tanupadanam vadami tanha hisavancha tasmin samaye upadanam hoti. At the time, vacha, when a being lays down this body and has reached a certain body, I say he is craving as his grasping. At that time, vacha, it is craving that serves as a grasping for him. Comment, translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. Master Gotama, when a flame is flung by the wind and goes some distance, what does Master Gotama declare to be its fuel on that occasion? When vacha, a flame is flung by the wind and goes some distance, I declare that it is fueled by the wind, for on that occasion the wind is its fuel. And Master Gotama, when a being has laid down this body but has not yet been reborn in another body, what does Master Gotama declare to be its fuel on that occasion? When vacha, a being has laid down this body but has not yet been reborn in another body, I declare that it is fueled by craving, for on that occasion craving is its fuel. And here is the same exchange in the Chinese parallel. Here again we have the flame being carried on by the wind, and that is, the Buddha explains that it is precisely the wind which serves as a support. It's not without any kind of support. And reaffirms that one more time, vacha then oneness, but it's just an empty space, so what could it be its support? And the Buddha affirms again that it is that the wind serves as its support. And then vacha asks, and here we have a more detailed formulation. So when the being has passed away and it's approaching a place of rebirth, independence on what is a kind of mind vehicle, it's a mind-made body actually, the Manomaya Kayam, what is his support? And then the Buddha explains, as in the Pali, that it's craving, independence on craving, it's support or grasping, and for that reason it's with a support. And here, at this point, Chinese then concludes. Vachagota says he has much to do, and the Buddha says, you do what you have to do, and then Vachagota leaves, rejoicing in the teaching. End of comment. With this sentence, the discourse ends abruptly, but there's an intricate point in the two sections quoted above. In these two sections, we have adopted the reading anupatto has reached as more plausible in rendering the phrase anyataram kayam anupatto has reached a certain body. The commentary, however, seeks to justify the reading anupapanno is not reborn, which gives quite an opposite sense, with the following explanation: chukti kana yeva patisandhi chintasa anupannata anupanno hoti. Since at the death moment itself the rebirth consciousness has not yet arisen, he is said to be not yet reborn. Some editors doubt whether the correct reading should be anupatto. The doubt seems reasonable enough, for even syntactically anupatto can be shown to fit into the context better than anupanno. The word anyataram provides us with the criterion. It has a selective sense, like a certain, and carries definite positive implications. To express something negative, a word like anyam, another, has to be used instead of the selective anyataram, a certain. On the other hand, the suggested reading anupatto avoids those syntactical difficulties. a being lays down this body and has reached a certain body. Even the simile given as an illustration is in favor of our interpretation. The original question of Bhatcha about the flame flung by the wind reminds us of the way a forest fire, for instance, spreads from one tree to another some distance away. It is the wind that pushes the flame for it to catch hold of the other tree. The commentarial explanation, however, envisages a situation in which a being lays down this body and is not yet reborn in another body. It is in this interim that craving is supposed to be the grasping or a fuel. Some scholars have exploited this commentarial explanation to postulate the theory of antarabhava, or interim existence, prior to rebirth proper. Our interpretation, based on the reading Anupattu, rules out even the possibility of an antarabhava. Comment, yeah, I am not entirely sure, but I assume that the Venerable is not intending to rule out an antarabhava in general, but just pointing out that the idea of basing the interim existence on this particular passage is doubtful because of the alternative reading Anupattu. The interim existence is clearly recognized in other early Buddhist discourses and is also an opinion accepted in the majority of Buddhist traditions, but not in the Theravada tradition. So the traditional Theravada position is that there is no interim existence, that death is followed immediately by rebirth. And I'm offering an extract from my recently published book on rebirth, just a few pages on this particular issue of the interim existence. And we can see this idea of an interim existence, particularly in this mind-made body, mentioned in the Chinese. But I mean, the basic point is clear that it is about this transition, and it is just as a fire when one tree burns and the wind blows in the direction of where another tree is standing, then that other tree will also catch fire, even though the two trees do not touch each other directly, but are maybe even at quite some distance. And so it is the same then applied to the living being that has passed away, and what ensures the transition to another living being, another physical body, and that this transition is ensured by craving. I think that is the main point of the passage and the simile. And here it does not really depend so much on whether one thinks that there needs to be an interim existence or not for this transition to take place. So I think Venerable Nyanananda is right that this particular passage is not a strong evidence for the interim existence as such. It simply makes sense on both readings, whether one believes in an interim existence or not, that there needs to be some explanations on how the mind, the mental process, consciousness, however we wish to call it, is able to proceed from one body to another body. And then the idea is that this takes place based on craving, similar to the possibility of fire moving from one wood to another wood without a need for these two woods to be in direct contact with each other. End of the comment. Obviously enough, Vajragotta's question is simple and straightforward. He is curious to know what sort of a grasping connects up the being that lays down the body and the being that arises in another body. That is to say, how the apparent gap could be bridged. The answer given by the Buddha fully accords with the analogy envisaged by the premise. Just as the wind does the work of grasping in the case of the flame, so craving itself at the moment of death fulfills the function of grasping for a being to reach another body. That is precisely why craving is called bhavanitti, the guide in becoming. Like a promontory, it juts out into the ocean of samsara. When it comes to rebirth, it is craving that bridges the apparent gap. It is the invisible combustible fuel that keeps the raging samsaric forest fire alive. All in all, what transpired at the debating hall, Kutu Halasala, reveals one important fact, namely that the Buddha's reluctance to give a categorical answer regarding the after-death state of the emancipated one in his dispensation had aroused the curiosity of those recluses and Brahmins. That is why they kept on discussing the subject at length. However, it was not the fact that he had refused to make any comment at all on this point, only that the comment he had made appeared so strange to them, as we may well infer from Vajragupta's report of the discussion at the debating hall. The Buddha's comment on the subject which they had quoted was not based on the Tetralemma. It was a completely new formulation. Atmacittanang vavantayi sanyojanang sammamanabhisamaya antamakkhasi dukkhassa. He cut off craving, disjoined the fetter, and by rightly understanding conceit for what it is, made an end of suffering. This then is the correct answer, and not any one of the four corners of the Tetralemma. This brief formula is of paramount importance. When craving is cut off, the guide in becoming, which is responsible for rebirth, is done away with. It is as if the fetter binding to another existence has been unhooked. The term bhava sanyojanakaya, destruction of the fetter to existence, we came across earlier, conveys the same sense. The phrase sammamanabhisamaya is also highly significant. With the dispelling of ignorance, the conceit M, asmimana, is seen for what it is. It disappears when exposed to the light of understanding, and that is the end of suffering as well. The concluding phrase antamakkhasi dukkhassa, made an end of suffering, is conclusive enough. The problem that was there all the time was the problem of suffering. So the end of suffering means the end of the whole problem. In the Angivachagotta Sutta of the Majjhima Nikaya, the Buddha's response to the question of the after-death state of the Arahant comes to light in greater detail. The question is presented there in the form of the Tetralemma, beginning with Honti Tathagato Paramarana. While all the other recluses and Brahmins held that the answer should necessarily take the form of one of the four alternatives, the Buddha put them all aside, Tapitani, rejected them, Patikittani, refused to state his view categorically in terms of them, Abhyakatani. This attitude of the Buddha puzzled not only the ascetics of other sects, but even some of the monks like Malankhyaputta. In very strong terms, Malankhyaputta challenged the Buddha to give a categorical answer or else confess his ignorance. As a matter of fact, there are altogether 10 such questions which the Buddha laid aside, rejected and refused to answer categorically. The first 6 take the form of 3 dilemmas, while the last 4 constitutes the Tetralemma already mentioned. Since an examination of those 3 dilemmas would reveal some important facts, we shall briefly discuss their significance as well. The 3 sets of views are stated thematically as follows. Sasato loko, the world is eternal. Asasato loko, the world is not eternal. Antava loko, the world is finite. Anantava loko, the world is infinite. Tang jivang, tang sarirang, the soul and the body are the same. Anyang jivang, anyang sarirang, the soul is one thing and the body another. These 3 dilemmas, together with the Tetralemma, are known as Abhyakatavattuni, the 10 undetermined points. Various recluses and Brahmins, as well as King Pasinadi Kosala, posed these 10 questions to the Buddha, hoping to get categorical answers. Why the Buddha laid them aside is a problem to many scholars. Some, like Malankhyaputta, would put it down to agnosticism. Others would claim that the Buddha laid them aside because they are irrelevant to the immediate problem of deliverance, though he could have answered them. that section of opinion go by the Singsapavana Sutta in the Satcha Samyutta of the Samyutta Nikaya. Once dwelling in a Singsapa grove, the Buddha took up some Singsapa leaves in his hands and asked the monks, "What do you think, monks, which is more, these leaves in my hand or those in the Singsapa grove?" The monks replied that the leaves in the hand are few, and those in the Singsapa grove are greater in number. Then the Buddha makes a declaration to the following effect. "Even so, monks, what I have understood through higher knowledge and not taught you is far more than what I have taught you. If we rely on this simile, we would have to grant that the questions are answerable in principle, but that the Buddha preferred to avoid them because they are not relevant. But this is not the reason either. All these 10 questions are based on wrong premises. To take them seriously and answer them would be to grant the validity of those premises. The dilemmas and the tetralemma seek arbitrarily to corner anyone who tries to answer them. The Buddha refused to be cornered that way. The first two alternatives presented in the form of a dilemma are sasato loko, the world is eternal, and asasato loko, the world is not eternal. This is an attempt to determine the world in temporal terms. The next set of alternatives seeks to determine the world in spatial terms. Why did the Buddha refuse to answer these questions on time and space? It is because the concept of the world has been given quite a new definition in this dispensation. Whenever the Buddha redefined a word in common usage, he introduced it with the phrase Ariyasa Vinaya, in the discipline of the noble ones. We have already mentioned on an earlier occasion that according to the discipline of the noble ones, the world is said to have arisen in the six sense spheres, Chassu Loko Samuppanno. In short, the world is redefined in terms of the six spheres of sense. This is so fundamentally important that in the Salayatana Samyutta of the Samyutta Nikaya, the theme comes up again and again. For instance, in the Samindi Sutta, Venerable Samindi poses the following question to the Buddha. Loko loko ti bhante ucchati, kittavatanuko bhante loko va asa loko panyattiva. The world, so it is said, Venerable Sir. But how far, Venerable Sir, does this world or the concept of the world go? The Buddha gives the following answer. Yatta kosam indi atticakku attirupa atticakku vinyanam atticakku vinyana vinyatabba dhamma attitata loko va loko loka panyattiva. Where there is the eye, Samindi, where there are forms. Where there is eye consciousness, where there are things cognizable by eye consciousness, there exists the world, or the concept of the world. Comment. Translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. Where there is the eye, Samindi, where there are forms, eye consciousness, things to be cognized by eye consciousness, there the world exists, or the description of the world. And here the Samyukta Agama parallel. The Buddha said to Samindi, that is the eye forms, eye consciousness, eye contact, and feeling arisen in dependence on eye contact and experience within, be it painful, pleasant or neutral, that is called the world. End of comment. A similar statement is made with regard to the other spheres of sense, including the mind. That, according to the Buddha, is where the world exists. Then he makes a declaration concerning the converse. Yatta chakko samindi nanti chakko natti rupa nanti chakko vinyana natti chakko vinyana vinyatabba dhamma natti tatta loko va loko appanyattiva. When there is no eye, Samindi, when there are no forms, when there is no eye consciousness, when there are no things cognizable by eye consciousness, there the world does not exist, nor any concept of the world. Comment, translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. When there is no eye, Samindi, no forms, no eye consciousness, no things to be cognized by eye consciousness, there the world does not exist, nor any description of the world. and the Samyukta Agama. So meaning if there is not that I, no form, no eye consciousness, no eye contact, and no feeling arisen in dependence on eye contact and experience within, be it painful, pleasant or neutral, then there's no world and also no designation of a world. End of comment. From this we can well infer that any attempt to determine whether there is an end of the world, either in temporal terms or in spatial terms, is misguided. It is the outcome of a wrong view, for there is a world so long as there are the six spheres of sense. That is why the Buddha consistently refused to answer those questions regarding the world. There are a number of definitions of the world given by the Buddha. We shall cite two of them. A certain monk directly asked the Buddha to give a definition of the world. Loko lokoti bhante vuccati, cittavatanuko bhante lokoti vuccati. The world, so it is said. In what respect, Venerable Sir, is it called a world? Then the Buddha makes the following significant declaration. Lunjati iti ko bhikkhu tasma lokoti vuccati. Kincha lunjati? Chakku ko bhikkhu lujjati, rupa lunjanti, chakku vinyanam lujjati, chakku sampassu lujjati, yampidam chakku sampassa pachaya upapajjati vedayatam sukkam va, dukkam va, adukkam asukkam va, tampi lujjati. Lujjati iti ko bhikkhu tasma lokoti vuccati. It is disintegrating monk. That is why it is called the world. And what is disintegrating? The eye monk is disintegrating, forms are disintegrating, eye consciousness is disintegrating, eye contact is disintegrating, and whatever feeling that arises dependent on eye contact, be it pleasant or painful, or neither pleasant nor painful, that too is disintegrating. It is disintegrating, monk. That is why it is called the world. Comment translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. It is disintegrating bhikkhu, therefore it is called the world. And what is disintegrating? The eye bhikkhu is disintegrating, forms are disintegrating, eye consciousness is disintegrating, eye contact is disintegrating, and whatever feeling arises with eye contact as condition, that too is disintegrating. The ear is disintegrating, the mind is disintegrating. Whatever feeling arises with mind contact as condition, that too is disintegrating. It is disintegrating bhikkhu, therefore it is called the world. Enter Samyukta Agama parallel. What is of a nature to be broken up and destroyed is called the world. What is of a nature to be broken up and destroyed? Samindi, the eye is of a nature to be broken up and destroyed. Likewise forms, eye consciousness, eye contact, and feeling arisen in dependence on eye contact and experience within, be it painful, pleasant or neutral. All that is of a nature to be broken up and destroyed. The ear, the nose, the tongue, the body, the mind is also like that. This is called being of a nature to be broken up and destroyed. This is called the world. End of comment. Here the Buddha is redefining the concept of the world, punning on the verb lujjati, which means to break up or disintegrate. To bring about a radical change in outlook in accordance with the Dhamma, the Buddha would sometimes introduce a new etymology in preference to the old. This definition of the world is to the same effect. Venerable Ananda too raises the same question, soliciting a redefinition for the well-known concept of the world, and the Buddha responds with the following answer. Yanko Ananda Paloka Dhammang Ayam Vuccati Aryasa Vinaye Loko. Whatever Ananda is subject to disintegration, that is called the world in the Noble One's discipline. He even goes on to substantiate his statement at length. Kincha Ananda Paloka Dhammam, Chakkunko Ananda Paloka Dhammam, Rupa Paloka Dhamma, Chakko Vinyana Paloka Dhammam, Chakku Sampasso Paloka Dhamma, Yampidam Chakku Sampasa Pachaya Upanjati Vidayatam Sukham Va Adukham Dukham Va Adukham Sukham Va Tampi Paloka Dhammam Yanko Ananda Paloka Dhammam Ayam Bucchati Aryasa Vinaye Loko. And what Ananda is subject to disintegration, the I Ananda is subject to disintegration, forms are subject to disintegration, I consciousness is subject to disintegration, I contact is subject to disintegration, and whatever feeling that arises dependent on eye contact, be it pleasant or painful, or neither pleasant nor painful, that too is subject to disintegration. Whatever is subject to disintegration, Ananda, is called the world in the Noble One's discipline. Comment? Translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. Whatever is subject to disintegration, Ananda, is called the world in the Noble One's discipline. And what is subject to disintegration? The I Ananda is subject to disintegration, forms, eye consciousness, eye contact. Whatever feeling arises with eye contact as condition, that too is subject to disintegration. The ear is subject to disintegration, the mind is subject to disintegration. Whatever feeling arises with mind contact as condition, that too is subject to disintegration. Whatever is subject to disintegration, Ananda, is called the world in the Noble One's discipline. In this instance, the play upon the word loka is vividly apt in that it brings out the transience of the world. If the world by definition is regarded as transient, it cannot be conceived substantially as a unit. How then can an eternity or infinity be predicated about it? If all the so-called things in the world listed above are all the time disintegrating, any unitary concept of the world is fallacious. Had the Buddha answered those misconceived questions, he would thereby concede to the wrong concept of the world current among other religious groups. So then we can understand why the Buddha refused to answer the first four questions. Now let us examine the next dilemma. Tang jivang tang sariram, anyang jivang anyang sariram. The soul and the body are the same, the soul is one thing and the body another. To these questions also the other religionists insisted on a categorical answer, either yes or no. There's a catch in the way these questions are framed. The Buddha refused to be caught by them. These two questions are of the type that clever lawyers put to respondent these days. They would sometimes insist strictly on a yes or no as answer, and ask a question like, have you now given up drinking? If the respondent happens to be a teetotaler, he would be in a quandary, since both answers tend to create a wrong impression. So also in the case of these two alternatives, the soul and the body are the same, the soul is one thing and the body another. Either way, there's a presumption of a soul, which the Buddha did not subscribe to. The Buddha had unequivocally declared that the idea of a soul is the outcome of an utterly foolish view. Kevalo paripuro bala dhammo. That is why the Buddha rejected both standpoints. A similar catch, a similar misconception, underlies the tetralemma concerning the after-death state of the Tathagata. It should be already clear to some extent by what we have discussed so far. For the Buddha, the term Tathagata had a different connotation than what it meant for those of other sects. The latter adhered to the view that both the ordinary disciple as well as the perfected individual in their systems of thought had a soul of some description or other. The Buddha never subscribed to such a view. On the other hand, he invested the term Tathagata with an extremely deep and subtle meaning. His definition of the term will emerge from the Agnivajjagotta Sutta, which we propose to discuss now. In this discourse, we find the wandering ascetic Vajjagotta trying to get a categorical answer to the questionnaire, putting each of the questions with legal precision one by one, as a lawyer would at the courts of law. King Nuko Bhogodama, Sasatu Loko, Idam Eva Satcham, Mogam Anyanti, Evang Diti Bhavang Gotama. Now, Master Gotama, the world is eternal. This only is true. All else is false. Are you of this view, Master Gotama? And the Buddha replies, Na koang vacca evang ditti. No, vacca, I am not of this view. Then Vajjagotta puts the opposite standpoint, which to the Buddha answers in the negative. To all the 10 questions, the Buddha answers no, thereby rejecting the questioner in toto. then Vachakota asks why, on seeing what danger, the Buddha refuses to hold any of those views. The Buddha gives the following explanation. Sasata loko tiko vacha dittigatang etang, dittigahanam, dittikantarang, dittivisukam, dittivipanditang, dittisangyojanam, sadukkam, savigatam, saupayasam, saparilahang, na nibidaya, na viragaya, na nirodhaya, na pasamaya, na vinyaya, na sambodhaya, na nibbanaya, san vatati. Vacha, this speculative view that the world is eternal, is a jungle of views, a desert of views, a distortion of views, an aberration of views, a fetter of views. It is fraught with suffering, with vexation, with despair, with delirium. It does not lead to disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, to tranquility, to higher knowledge, to enlightenment, to nirvana. So with regard to the other nine views. Comment translation by Nyanamoli. Vacha, the speculative view that the world is eternal is a thicket of views, a wilderness of views, a contortion of views, a vacillation of views, a fetter of views. It is beset by suffering, by vexation, by despair, and by fever, and it does not lead to disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to nibbana. And here I've given the Chinese parallel, which is similar. End of comment. Now, here we find both the above-mentioned reasons. Not only the fact that these questions are not relevant to the attainment of Nibbana, but also the fact that there is something wrong in the very statement of the problems. What are the dangers that he sees in holding any of these views? Every one of them is just a speculative view, dittigatam, a jungle of views, dittigahanam, an arid desert of views, dittikantaram, a mimicry or distortion of views, dittivisukam, an aberration of views, dittivipanditam, a fetter of views, dittisanyojanam. They bring about suffering, sadukkam, vexation, savigatam, despair, saupayasam, delirium, saparilaham. They do not conduce to disenchantment, nanipumidaya, to dispassion, abiragaya, to cessation, na nirodhaya, to tranquility, na upasamaya, to higher knowledge, na abhinyaya, to enlightenment, na sambodhaya, to extinguishment, na nibbanaya. From this declaration, it is obvious that these questions are ill-founded and misconceived. They are a welter of false views, so much so that the Buddha even declares that these questions simply do not exist for the noble disciple who has heard the Dhamma. They occur as real problems only to the untaught worldling. Why is that? Whoever has a deep understanding of the Four Noble Truths would not even raise these questions. This declaration should be enough for one to understand why the Buddha refused to answer them. Explaining that it is because of these dangers that he rejects them in toto, the Buddha now makes clear what his own stance is. Instead of holding any of those speculative views, he has seen for himself the rise, samudaya, and fall, attagama, of the five aggregates as a matter of direct experience, thereby getting rid of all eyeing and mying and latencies to conceits, winning ultimate release. Even after this explanation, Vachagota resorts to the fourfold lodging to satisfy his curiosity about the after-death state of the monk thus released in mind. Even vimutta chittupana bhogotamo bhikkhu kuhin upapajjati. When a monk is thus released in mind, Master Gotama, where is he reborn? The Buddha replies, Upanjati ediko vacha naupeti. To say that he is reborn, vacha falls short of a reply. Then Vachakota asks, Tena hibo Gotama naupanjati. If that is so, Master Gotama, is he not reborn? Naupanjati ediko vacha naupeti. To say that he is not reborn, vacha falls short of a reply. Tenahi bho Gotama upanjati cha nacha upanjati. If that is so, Master Gotama, is he both reborn and is not reborn? Upanjati cha nacha upanjati te ko vacha naupeti. to say that he is both reborn and is not reborn, Vajra falls short of reply. Tenahi Bhogotama Neva Umbanjati Na Upanjati. If that is so, Master Gotama, is he neither reborn nor is not reborn? Neva Upanjati Na Upanjati Itiko Vajra Na Upeti. To say that he is neither reborn nor is not reborn, Vajra falls short of a reply. At this unexpected response of the Buddha to his four questions, Vajragata confesses that he is fully confused and bewildered. The Buddha grants that his confusion and bewilderment are understandable, since this Dhamma is so deep and subtle that it cannot be plumbed by logic, ataka vacharo. However, in order to give him a clue to understanding the Dhamma point of view, he gives an illustration in the form of catechism. Tankin manyasi bacchan, sacchiti purato agi jalaya jane yasi tang, ayang me purato agi jalateti. What do you think, Vajra? Suppose a fire were burning before you. Would you know this fire is burning before me? Sachame bo gotama purato agi jalaya, jane ya hangayame purato agi jalateti. If Master Gotama, a fire were burning before me, I would know this fire is burning before me. Sachipanatang bhaccha evang puchayam, yote ayang purato agi jalati, ayang agi king paticcha jalatiti, evang puttotvang bhaccha kinti bhyakare yasi. If someone were to ask you, Vajra, what does this fire that is burning before you burn independence on? Being asked thus, Vajra, what would you answer? Evang puttu ahang bho gotama evang vyakareyam. Yome ayang purato agi jalati, ayang agi tinna kattupa dhanang paticcha jalati de. Being asked thus, Master Gotama, I would answer, this fire burning before me burns in dependence on grass and sticks. Sachite vacha purato su agi nibbayaya, janeya sitvang, ayang me purato agi nibbutoti. If that fire before you were to be extinguished, Vajra, would you know this fire before me has been extinguished? Sachame bho gotamo puratasu agi nibbayaya, janaya hang ayame puratu agi nibbutoti. If that fire before me were to be extinguished, Master Gotama, I would know this fire before me has been extinguished. Sachipanatang bhaccha evang puccheya, yotyayang puratu agi nimbutu, su agi itu katamang disangatu, puratimang va, dakinang va, pachimang va, uttarang vati, evang puttutvang bhaccha kinti vyakari yasi. If someone were to ask you, Vajra, when that fire before you were extinguished, to which direction did it go? To the east, the west, the north, or the south? Being asked thus, what would you answer? Nau peti bhogotama. Yaniswa bhogotama agi tinna katupadana patichit jalati, tasacha pariyadana, anyasacha anupahara, anaharu nimbututreva sankangachati. That wouldn't do us a reply, Master Gotama, for that fire burnt in dependence on its fuel of grass and sticks. That being used up and not getting any more fuel, being without fuel, it is reckoned as extinguished. Comment, translation by Nyanamoli of the whole. What do you think, Vajra? Suppose a fire were burning before you, would you know that fire is burning before me? I would, Master Gotama. If someone were to ask you, Vajra, what does this fire burning before you burn independence on? Being asked thus, what would you answer? Being asked thus, Master Gotama, I would answer, this fire burns independence on fuel of grass and sticks. If that fire before you were to be extinguished, would you know this fire before me has been extinguished? I would, Master Gotama. If someone were to ask you, Vajra, when that fire before you was extinguished, to which direction did it go? To the east, the west, the north, or the south? Being asked thus, what would you answer? That does not apply, Master Gotama. The fire burned in dependence on its fuel of grass and sticks. When that is used up, if it does not get any more fuel, being without fuel, it is reckoned as extinguished. And here I have pasted in the Chinese parallel, which is quite similar. End of comment. At this point, a very important expression comes up, which we happened to discuss earlier too, namely Sankham Gacchati. It means to be reckoned, or to be known as, or to be designated. So the correct mode of designation in this case is to say that the fire is reckoned as extinguished, and not to say that it has gone somewhere. If one takes mean advantage of the expression fire has gone out and insists on locating it, it will only be a misuse or an abuse of linguistic usage. It reveals a pervert tendency to misunderstand and misinterpret. Therefore, all that can be said by way of predicating such a situation is nimbutu tveva sankam gacchati. It is reckoned as extinguished. Now comes a well-timed declaration in which the Buddha, starting right from where Vachagota leaves off, brings the whole discussion to a climatic end. Eva meva ko vaccha yena rupena tathagatam panyapayamana panyapeya. Tang rupang tathagatasya pahinam uccinna moolam thalavattukatam anabhavakatam ayatina upada dhammam. Rupa sanka vimutto ko vaccha tathagato gambhiro appameyo duppariyo gaho sayatapi mahasamunyo. Upanjatiti na upeti, na upanjatiti na upeti, upanjaticha na cha upanjatiti na upeti. Neva pajati na na upajatiti na upeti. Even so, Vacha, that form by which one designating the Tathagata might designate him, that has been abandoned by him, cut off at the root, made like an uprooted palm tree, made non-existent and incapable of arising again. The Tathagata is free from reckonings in terms of form, Vacha. He is deep, immeasurable and hard to fathom, like the great ocean. To say that he is reborn falls short of a reply. To say that he is not reborn falls short of a reply. To say that he is both reborn and is not reborn falls short of a reply. To say that he is neither reborn nor is not reborn falls short of a reply. Common translation by Nyanamoli. So to Vacha, the Tathagata has abandoned that material form by which one describing the Tathagata might describe him. He has cut it off at the root, made it like a palm stump, done away with it so that it is no longer subject to future rising. The Tathagata is liberated from reckoning in terms of material form, Vacha. He is profound, immeasurable, hard to fathom like the ocean. He reappears, does not apply. He does not reappear, does not apply. He both reappears and does not reappear, does not apply. He neither reappears nor does not reappear, does not apply. So here is the Chinese parallel, which also describes the abandoning of all the aggregates and compares this to cutting off the head of a palmyra tree. It does not give the simile of the ocean, but it still states that it is deep and profound. End of comment. This declaration, which fully convinced Vachagota now wholeheartedly hailed and compared to the very heartwood of a sala tree, enshrines an extremely profound norm of Dhamma. It was when Vachagota had granted the fact that it is improper to ask in which direction an extinguished fire has gone, and that the only proper linguistic usage is simply to say that it is extinguished, that the Buddha came out with this profound pronouncement concerning the five aggregates. In the case of the Tathagata, the aggregate of form, for instance, is abundant, pahinam, cut off at the root, utchinnamulam, made like an uprooted palm tree divested from its side, thalavattukatam, made non-existent, anabhavakatam, and incapable of arising again, ayatinganupada dhammam. Thereby the Tathagata becomes free from reckoning in terms of form, rupa sankha vimutta ko tathagatam. Due to this very freedom he becomes deep, immeasurable and unfathomable like the great ocean. Therefore he cannot be said to be reborn or not to be reborn, or both, or neither. The abandonment of form referred to above comes about not by death or destruction, but by the abandonment of craving. The fact that by the abandonment of craving itself, form is abandoned or eradicated, comes to light from the following quotation from the Radha Samyutta of the Samyutta Nikaya. Rupiko Radha Yo Chando Yo Rago Ya Nandi Ya Tanha Tang Pajata. evaṁ taṁ rūpaṁ pahīnaṁ bhavisati ucchinna mūlaṁ thāla vantukataṁ anabhāvakataṁ āyatiṁ anuppāda dhammam. Rāna, you give up that desire, that lust, that delight, that craving for form. It is thus that form comes to be abundant, cut off at the root, made like an uprooted palm tree, made non-existent and incapable of arising again. Worldlings are under the impression that an arahant's five aggregates of grasping get destroyed at death. But according to this declaration, an arahant is like an uprooted palm tree. A palm tree, uprooted but left standing, divested of its sight, might appear as a real palm tree to one who sees it from a distance. Similarly, an untaught worldling thinks that there is a being or person in truth and fact, when he hears the term Tathagata, even in this context too. This is the insinuation underlying the above-quoted pronouncement. It has some profound implications, but time does not permit us to go into them today. Thank you very much for your attention.